Hey there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this week's episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mysteries, alternative historical theories, and lost civilizations. This week's episode is brought to you by Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. Visit innertraditions.com to learn more about their books, authors, sign up for catalogs, coupons, and special offers. I read tons and tons of books on historical mysteries, lost civilizations, alternative theories, so on and so forth. And I have to say, Inner Traditions has a massive, massive catalog. Their books are authored by some of the best-known researchers in the field, and we've really enjoyed working with them here at Lost Origins. All right, well, this week we have the privilege of chatting with author and researcher Laird Scranton. Laird is a recognized authority on ancient cosmology and language, and today we're going to be talking to him about his research surrounding the Dogon tribe of Africa, his newest book, Point of Origin, and of course, his take on the ancient site of Göbekli Tepe. All that and more coming up right after the break. All right, and we are back. Ladies and gentlemen, I am so excited for today's show. Today, we have the outstanding privilege of chatting with Laird Scranton. Laird is a recognized authority on ancient cosmology, Dogon mythology, and language, and he's authored several books, including Sacred Symbols of the Dogon, China's Cosmological Prehistory, and of course, most recently, Point of Origin. Laird is a frequent radio guest on shows like Coast to Coast, and he's also made appearances in documentaries, including one of my all-time favorites, The Pyramid Code. His latest book, Point of Origins, Laird explains how Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is our point of origin for our ancestral cosmologies, esoteric teachings, stone masonry, agriculture, and other critical skill sets. Laird, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you, Andrew, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're really excited to pick your brain a little bit. I've read the majority of your work. I've listened to a ton of interviews that you've done, and I never walk away from a Laird Scranton experience without my mind just being blown. So I'm really excited to chat with you.
My wife jokes that one day I'm going to turn up some piece of evidence that will be just absolutely pivotal and our whole world will go poof and just disappear.
And that's awesome. So your latest book, Point of Origin, that's your most recent book on Inner Traditions. But
that's right.
You have a new book that's about ready to come out, correct?
There's a book called The Mystery of Scarab Ray, which is at the publisher now. It won't be out till probably December or January.
Okay. Very cool. And so with all the books that you've written, Point of Origin was your fifth book, I believe, correct?
Actually, my sixth. I've written five on cosmology and another one on sort of a side topic. I wrote about Immanuel Velikovsky, who was a colleague of Einstein's.
And that was actually your first book that you self-published, is that correct?
No, the first book I self-published was called Hidden Meanings, and it was republished as The Science of the Dogon.
Okay, very good. So one thing that, A, I want to commend you on, and B, I'd like to know a little bit more about, is this high standard that I always hear about that you hold yourself with respect to how you accept data, how you check, double check, triple check, just to make sure that everything you are releasing is sound. Can you tell us a little bit more about your research process?
Sure. The biggest threat to a person who does the kind of work I do is really their own wishfulness. You know, if you imagine as a child lying out in the field looking up at the clouds, you see images, the brain is wired to find patterns even where they don't arguably exist. Uh-huh. And so it's a danger for a researcher like me to go chasing off after something that looks like it's a real relationship or a real symbolic interpretation, but right, isn't, turns out to be nothing. So I make a couple of rules to try to prevent that from happening. The mm-hmm. first rule is that every interpretation needs to start with a clear statement on the part of the culture that I'm studying. And it helps if other cultures see the issue the same way. Mm-hmm. And then the second piece of it really is on the far end. Once I've developed an interpretation, I need to be able to finish a fairly straightforward question. I ask myself, we know this must be true because, and if I can finish that question in a direct way, then I know I have something
then that you're onto something.
Will hold up.
Right. Very good. Well, that's awesome, because I think far too often, especially with the world of the internet, people will grasp to a theory, or you know, they'll come up with something and it gets published or printed or taken to the web very, very quickly, and then it just gets chewed up by the world that is Reddit, for example, right? So,
well, as we go along and have access to more reliable sources, a greater number of reliable sources, it's possible to cross-reference things. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you get a better sense of, you can sort of triangulate in on what the truth of something's got to be.
Sure, sure. So building on that, you know, there's so many similarities between ancient cultures, especially their creation myths, cosmologies, and I find it just mind-boggling. So maybe before we dig into point of origin, maybe for our listeners that aren't super familiar with your research and your work, maybe you could provide us kind of a bit of background on yourself and what really started you down the path of researching ancient cosmologies.
Okay. Well, I started out, I was given a book by my wife, Risa, to read called Unexplained by Jerome Clark that talked about this modern African tribe called the Dogon. Okay. They're a modern primitive tribe, and they knew some things about astronomy they shouldn't know. And so I was fortunate to have that be my starting point, because their culture combines elements from several other ancient traditions that are very important. They have rituals like ancient Judaism, and they have civic traditions like ancient Egypt, and they have a creation system that is a lot like ancient Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So it was a really good starting point in terms of being able to imagine that there were commonalities from culture to culture. My work basically falls in the field that's called comparative cosmology, and what that means is trying to learn more about these symbols and myths and mythic traditions, the rituals of these cultures, by comparing multiple cultures that do the same thing. Like, I think Herodotus was the person who was of the opinion that all cultures that circumcised had gotten it from ancient Egypt. Mm. Well, if you compare what each of these cultures think about circumcision, then you can start to narrow in on what it might represent. Mm-hmm. So that's basically my process. My first book was called The Science of the Dogon. The Dogon priests say that their symbols describe how matter forms. And I didn't know very much about matter at the time I started reading about it, but I knew that they had correctly described an atom and correctly described protons and electrons and neutrons, and they had a drawing that was a picture of an electron orbit.
Wow.
And so I thought, if they have the top two levels of this right, what are the chances that the descending structure they described was also right? Mm-hmm. And so I started educating myself about that. And so The Science of the Dogon basically is a side-by-side presentation of what the Dogon say about this creational science and what modern like Brian Greene or Stephen Hawking say.
Sure.
And that led into a second book called Sacred Symbols of the Dogon that's more about how Egyptian language works. There are commonalities between what Dogon drawings and Egyptian lifts, and that gave some insights, some new insights into how Egyptian words should be read.
Right.
From there, I used things that I could say positively about those two cultures as a way of predicting what would be true about a Tibetan tribe. The Dogon system is a match for Buddhism, so I could use that also and predict, here are some common elements that let me know that this small Tibetan tribe up on the borderland of Tibet and China came out of the same tradition. And so I made certain predictions based on the cultures I'd already studied and demonstrated how those play out with the Tibetan tribe.
Wow.
Then I wrote a book about ancient China. China is a special case because there's a lack of evidence there, and so there's lots of arguments about what certain words and terms and concepts mean. But because of the way these commonalities work, I could actually use African and Egyptian and Buddhist references to clarify what the Chinese symbols were about.
Wow. And so the Dogon then, they have a very special connection or a pretty in-depth understanding of Sirius, correct?
That was sort of the entry point. There was a book written in 1975 by Robert Temple called The Sirius Mystery. Mm-hmm. And the mystery was, how could this primitive, this outwardly primitive African tribe understand that in the bright glare of this star Sirius, there was hidden a second star, a little dwarf star? Not only did they know the second star was there, but they also knew the correct orbital period for the two stars. And so how could they possibly know that? And he approached the topic as if it were evidence of an alien contact to this African tribe.
Sure. So, like, it's just mind-boggling that they would know about this, right?
Right, and the easy answer was given by Carl Sagan. He responded to that book by saying, well, clearly what's happened here is some modern visitor spent some time with the tribe members and told them about what astronomers know about these two stars, sure, and they just adopted that as part of their lore. But if he had explored the issue just a little bit farther, he would have realized that the words that the African tribe uses to express all this stuff are ancient Egyptian words that went out of use around 750 BC. And I can't conceive of a modern visitor having used those words.
Right.
And then also, if you go to ancient Egypt, there's sort of a symbolism is sort of like a game. You know, we know that the goddess Isis in Israel, or in Egypt, represents Sirius. Mm-hmm. But in order to be able to say that, we're sort of tacitly agreeing to play a symbolic game that I call, you say goddess, I say star. Mm-hmm. So when the ancient Egyptian myths tell us that Sirius has a dark sister named Nephthys, that implies that there's a second star there. Mm-hmm. The ancient Egyptians knew it too.
Wow. That's just fascinating. So let's move into point of origin. I'm holding a copy of it here in my book. Or here in my hand, excuse me. And this book was incredible. We gave it a very good review here on our site as well. And the cover has one of the pillars from Göbekli Tepe on it. But
that's right.
The book isn't really about Göbekli Tepe. Göbekli Tepe just kind of plays a role in the book. But you're basically using cosmology, symbols, and language to kind of trace back the origin of our civilization, correct?
Right. The cultures that I've been studying date from around 3000 BC, but mm-hmm. Göbekli Tepe is much older. It's from around 10,000 BC.
Right.
But the symbolic elements that we find there, which are standing stones and stones placed in circles, megalithic and multi-ton stones that have beautiful carvings of animals on them. Mm-hmm. It's a hill, like a mountaintop sanctuary with these stones on it. A lot of the symbolic elements are things that are very familiar to somebody like me who studies 3000 BC era stuff. There are animals pictured there that have significance symbolically in the cosmology, mm-hmm. and that were selected as icons by for deities and for rulers, kings and queens, mm-hmm. In the 3000 BC era. So my purpose with the book was to try to find a way to trace those very archaic elements forward to the more recent periods of 3000 BC.
Right. So maybe for some of the listeners that aren't super familiar with Göbekli Tepe, I know that it's been in the news quite a bit lately, but maybe give us a little bit more of some more background on the site itself, and maybe tell us a little bit about what about the site kind of drew you in and inspired you to have that become a focal point for some of your research.
Well, the site is located in southeastern Turkey, mm-hmm. which is part of what we consider to be the Fertile Crescent back in ancient times. Mm-hmm. It is so old that it actually precedes the earliest evidence that scientists have of the tools that would be required to build it. It's
wow.
very, very old. And it has been excavated from an archaeological strata that relates to a period where people thought that only hunter-gatherers lived. How could they have built these structures with using these huge carved stones. How would they move them? How would they quarry them? And so forth,
right,
to produce this site. Nobody knows for sure what the site was used for, because it's clear that it wasn't a city. It wasn't a habitation, because they don't have any of the usual garbage, really, that a city would produce.
Sure.
They know it wasn't a burial site because they haven't found enough bones for it to have been that.
Right.
They know it wasn't located in a way that would make it a strategic fort. So what was it used for?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a ritual site that people came to for some reason, that right, they came back to again and again.
Well, and that's what you find online, too. People saying it's like temples, right?
Right. Yeah. And because we don't have written texts that go back beyond 3000 BC, it's hard to know what it was for a person like me to try to anchor an interpretation and say, look, this was a temple. It wasn't a shopping mall.
Right.
You know, there has to be a basis for saying that.
Right.
Well, in some of the traditions, the later traditions I'm studying, when you get down to the bottom of them, they say that they acquired certain civilizing skills and certain scientific knowledge through instruction from ancient teachers who knew more than they did. And they say that this instruction was carried out at remote sites.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first impulse is, or my first impulse was, seeing the pillars with the carved animals that relate to cosmology, was that this could potentially have been one of the sites where they were instructed.
Right.
Now, that point of view is supported by the idea, it's supported by the fact that in that same region of southern Turkey, southeastern Turkey, you find the first evidence of cultivated grains. You find the first evidence of domesticated animals,
mm-hmm,
and of metallurgy, working with metals. This is the first example of stone carving. So clearly we have a lot of civilizing skills, and arguably the same list of civilizing skills that these later cultures are talking about, all appearing in one location at the same moment. So it could reasonably have been a place where instruction happened.
Right. So wouldn't this basically be the indicative of civilization having gone back much further than the date that is associated with Göbekli Tepe? Because it seems kind of strange to me that just, you know, the site predates the tools, like you had mentioned, and then it's also animal husbandry and where agriculture first pops up. I mean, that's just the first time it pops up in terms of the timeline that we understand. I mean, these aren't simple carvings on these pillars, right? I mean, it's high relief and low relief. I mean, very, very detailed. I think, doesn't that mean that civilization would have to have gone back much further than Göbekli Tepe itself?
That's hard to say, because we have the obstacle of the Ice Age sitting in the way of us being able to figure that out. It
right,
sort of wiped a lot of the evidence clean. So we sort of have a clean slate that begins at the end of the Ice Age, and we can only interpret things forward from that.
Right.
But there are some clues. The ancient Egyptians talk about something they call the first time, and the Buddhists talk about the first time that knowledge was passed to humanity by a Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same context, the Dogon talk about a time when society was restored to culture. So they're all talking about the same, very similar things to one another. They're mm-hmm, talking about the same kind of event. But in the Dogon perspective, this wasn't the first time. This was a recovery from some kind of a disaster.
Right.
And that could make sense, because the Ice Age would have created that kind of a disaster. And you can imagine if on a global scale, or on an extra global scale, that there are attempts at recovery comparable to what FEMA does after a hurricane, mm-hmm, or what the Peace Corps does after a disaster, an earthquake in a country. You can imagine that there might have been an effort mounted by somebody to help us recover from the Ice Age.
Right. Wow. So do you think that maybe with all of the worldwide flood myths and the stories of the deluge that, you know, were global, do you think that we're looking at something that also ties into all the similarities you're finding between the ancient cultures and then also the end of the Ice Age that kind of wiped the slate clean? I mean, is this kind of our species pointing back to this event that we can't remember or we don't really want to remember?
That could be true, because the Göbekli Tepe site was deliberately and carefully buried about 1,000 years after it was built.
Right.
And there's a lot of debate about what the motive was for doing that. They can tell by the kinds of materials that were used to bury it with, and the care that was taken not to damage the carvings on the pillars and things like that, mm-hmm. that whoever buried it was not trying to destroy it. They were trying to preserve it.
Right.
So if they were trying to preserve it, what was the audience they were trying to preserve it for? Well, the suggestion is that it was an audience that was more highly technologically capable than say, the ancient Egyptians. Mm-hmm. So my entry point into being able to trace this stuff is really language. Even though there aren't written texts available at 10,000 BC, there are a couple of features of language that help us sort things out.
Sure.
The first is that the farther back in time we go, the more commonality of language we seem to find.
Right.
That each of the animals pictured on the Göbekli Tepe pillars, if we look at the names of those language in the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, we discover they're all pronounced like important terms of cosmology. Mm-hmm. They're homonyms. And so you can imagine that they're symbolic of cosmology if we postulate that the language was similar.
Right.
The site Göbekli Tepe itself, in the modern Turkish language, the word tepe has upwards of 25 different meanings. If you go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic language at 3000 BC, you can find at least a dozen of those same meanings, mm-hmm. with the same or similar pronunciation. So we have commonality of language that we can use.
Okay.
There's a second feature of language, and that's called ultra-conserved words. And that's the tendency of words that are important to a culture to stay in their languages for very long periods of time. And so we can look at a modern Turkish dictionary and find references to things that are important to us at earlier periods of time.
Wow. Wow. So let's go back to real quick. You had mentioned Göbekli Tepe. We know that the site was deliberately buried. I can't remember where I read it, but and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that portions of the site were buried at different times that also coincided with the building of new portions of the site. Is that correct? And B, why do you think that took place?
No, to my knowledge, I mean, I'm not sure they can say categorically when they were buried.
Sure.
Because that kind of, they have to have a test. I suppose someone could do a test and figure that out.
Sure.
My understanding is that we have at least 15 different circles there, stone circles there, that are of similar nature to one another. Why they would need so many, I'm not sure. But that the earlier ones were not decommissioned, as the archaeologists say, before the new ones were built.
Mm-hmm.
So from my point of view, that could represent, you know, each of these circles might represent sort of the final project of a team of students who were learning how to do stone carving.
Mm-hmm.
That's a possibility.
So there's tons of theories out there as to what this thing was. I think my favorite so far was from today's conversation, an ancient shopping mall, right? Like just this old this old ancient IKEA hanging out in Turkey.
Yeah.
but seriously, the theory that you've put forth in Point of Origin that this was an ancient megalithic university, and that this is potentially why we see such strong similarities in megalithic construction all over the world. Can you talk a little bit more to that, maybe about how you arrived to that conclusion and a little bit of the research that went into that?
One way we get at it is, okay, looking retrospectively from the later cultures, you get down to the bottom of these traditions and they're all saying the same thing. They're not saying, you know, these symbols we have, there was a guy named Joe who figured them out. You know, my great-great-grandfather Joe figured these out, mm-hmm. and we preserve them. They're all saying, you know, back in archaic times, somebody who – we had a set of mythic teachers or quasi-mythic teachers who taught this stuff to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we have commonality point of view of the cultures who have retained this stuff about where they think it came from. And many of them also say that they learned it at a remote site. Now, to give you some perspective on that, the Buddhists flatly say that their most sacred symbols came from a non-human source. And the Dogons say theirs came from a non-human source, but not only was it non-human, it was also non-material in a complicated way. Now, those are statements that are hard for a person like me to evaluate, but I'll explain what kind of a situation I'm in about them.
Okay.
The Buddhist and Dogen cosmologies are a match for one another. They are very much in parallel. You can correlate symbols and words, and not so much the form of words, but the meanings of words, symbols and concepts and things back and forth between the two. They're a matching system. They're based on the same grand symbol. Buddhism was documented by around 400 BC. The Dogen system is couched in words that went out of use by 750 BC and seem to reflect things that go back as far as 3000 BC.
Wow.
So we have, and they're given in two different languages. The Buddhist system is given in Sanskrit, and the Dogen is given in ancient Egyptian, what look like Egyptian hieroglyphic words in terms of how they're pronounced. So it doesn't look like one culture just received the tradition wholesale from the other because they didn't share any of the same words.
Wow.
So the indication is that both cultures managed to keep their systems, these very complicated systems of symbols, straight for thousands of years all the way down to the current day when they're still a match.
Mm-hmm.
If they hadn't, they wouldn't still match.
Right.
So I'm in the position of saying I can either postulate that they kept all of those intimate details straight, but then somehow both misremembered in the same way where they got it from. Or I can say that they kept that last final detail of where they got it from straight also, and that now we have to at least entertain the possibility that they got it from somebody who wasn't human.
Okay.
So that's the starting point here. We may have non-human involvement. And if we do, then that changes the ballgame a little bit because both the science that's reflected in the system
mm-hmm.
and the claim that it was non-human implies that we had somebody on the scene in ancient times who was much more capable than we're imagining,
mm-hmm.
somebody who might have been globally capable. So the idea that they might have been able to take somebody off to a remote locale and teach them becomes thinkable. Now, the Dogen say that the reason they did that was to solve a problem. The teachers were concerned about potentially bad health effects on us from being around them. And so the way they limited that was they took 8 tribes people from the Dogen tribe and sequestered them at a remote site, instructed those 8 people and sent them back to teach everybody else. And that's a pattern, that's sort of a mythic pattern that we see repeated all around the world in various countries, you know, in China and in the Americas and elsewhere, that this idea that 8 mythic teachers came with and taught civilizing skills. It's just a repeating theme everywhere. So it looks as if they might be telling us the truth and that the same thing might have happened to cultures all around the world.
Wow.
And if so, then we're looking for a potential remote site where that might have happened. Göbekli Tepe gives the appearance of being one of those kinds of sites.
Wow.
So one of the cosmological themes that you're returning to over and over again is the importance of Orion, Sirius, and Barnard's Loop. Why are these three celestial bodies so important?
That was one of the key questions to try to answer over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of Sirius, the knee-jerk reaction is if we have non-humans involved, Sirius would seem to be important because you would guess that the teachers came from Sirius.
Mm-hmm.
That would make perfect sense. But the Dogen throw sort of a wrinkle into it. They say, no, these were not sci-fi aliens we're talking about. There's something involving interdimensionality going on here. And to understand what it is, you need to understand sort of the archaic view of things.
Mm-hmm.
In the archaic philosophies that underlie all this stuff, the theme is that our material universe has a non-material twin that we're not aware of. I compare it to the blind spot in your car. If the driver's driving in the car and using his mirrors to see things,
right.
He might not be aware that there's a blind spot there big enough to hide a tractor trailer.
Right.
Well, these cultures are telling us that we think we see everything, but the truth is there's a blind spot, and in that blind spot is a twin universe that is non-material. That routine attempts are made to communicate information from the non-material side to the material side, that it happens through dreams and through coincidences and through the behavior of animals and through shamans, that through divination and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the mindset that this is coming out of. And in that mindset, what we're having to consider is there a possibility that, okay, the non-material side is characterized as having perfect knowledge, mm-hmm. but imperfect ability to act. And the reason that is because of what happens to the concept of time as we reduce mass. This gets down to Einstein. As mass, or as acceleration increases, which is effectively the same as mass increasing, time frame slows down. And as we follow that in reverse back down to, you know, we reduce mass rather than increasing it, we get down to a point where we have virtually massless waves. They must reside in a time frame that is ultra fast compared to ours.
Mm-hmm.
So the indication is that the non-material side knows everything about what's going to happen, but because time happens instantly there, it'd be like having all the songs on a CD. You're holding the CD in your hand is what they're doing. Where on our side, we're playing the CD sequentially one song at a time.
Right.
That's effectively the difference in time frame that's going on here. So the idea is that the non-material side has no ability to act because they don't have the duration of time in which to act.
Right.
And so there are communication attempts being made from that side to our side where we have imperfect knowledge but full ability to act. It'd be sort of – I compare it to what's called locked-in syndrome for a person.
Mm-hmm.
If you imagine a person whose body no longer works but their brain is still completely cognizant,
mm-hmm.
there's a problem there on how to communicate to the outside world.
Sure.
So the idea is that somehow the non-material side was able to create a material presence and affect education of us back at around – starting at about around 10,000 BC.
Wow.
That's essentially the scenario that we're looking at.
Okay. So, and this is multiple ancient cultures that make reference to the non-material universe then, correct?
Yes. You see it in Kabbalism. You see it in Buddhism. You see it in African religions like the Dogon religion. You see it in ancient Egypt, talking about there's a lot of emphasis there on two realms, a living realm and a non-living realm. The non-material realm is associated with the concept of of death,
sure.
things like that. So, and they're all describing things the same way. We can correlate the words, we can correlate the symbols. We know they're talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if it was one instance of it, like one culture only making reference to this, I mean, that's pretty easy to discredit. But when you have multiple cultures from antiquity, from all over the world, talking about this, I mean, it seems to me like this should be something that more people are paying attention to, you would think, right?
Right. But the whole scenario is inherently unbelievable, you know, incredible.
Sure.
And that's part of the problem with someone trying to express it is that how can this possibly be true? If it was your job to convince somebody that this was true, how would you go about doing that? Well, the way it looks as if these mythic teachers went about doing it was in preparation for telling us that final piece, which is a completely unbelievable piece, they prefaced it with a much more detailed piece that established their credibility for what they were saying. And the credible piece was they accurate about matter forms, which is something that no one in antiquity should have known. They correctly describe from waves to atom, and they actually go farther down the chain than modern astrophysics do. They accurately explain to us how matter forms. And through doing that, they basically said to us, look, this demonstrates that we know what we're talking about. Now listen.
Right.
And then they proceed to tell you the thing that's completely unbelievable, that there's a second realm here that we have no idea even exists.
Hmm. Wow. So, like I said at the beginning, looking forward to that one moment that's just the mind-blowing piece. It's pretty incredible. And just the fact that it's all over the ancient world, like that, to me, that's pretty mind-blowing.
Now, we have been talking about the astronomic bodies. I didn't really get to that.
Sure.
As part of this scenario, we have emphasis on Sirius, which is the bright stars that we see in the night sky. There are at least two of them. There's a bright sun-like star and a small dwarf star that's dark that you have a hard time seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that you can find those is by drawing an imaginary line in your mind through the three belt stars of Orion, mm-hmm. and following it down to the left and downward, and it points to roughly to where Sirius is.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a third structure there that isn't obvious. There's a spiraling birthplace of stars that's part of the Orion Nebula. It's called Barnard's Loop, and it's so faint that you have to use time-lapse photography to be able to see it. The Dogon refer to that as the Chariot of Orion. And the reason they do is because when it's imaged with time-lapse photography, the spiral that gets created, which centers right on the belt stars, looks like the wheel of a chariot that Orion the Hunter is standing in. So another way that the Dogon established credibility with me was by providing the clues that led me to understand that Barnard's Loop exists there. We get to that through Dogon myths that equate the concept of a cubit with a light year. And if we follow where we understand and where we got the notion of cubits from, we learned about the concept of cubits. We sort of reverse engineered that from the dimensions of the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember, Robert Bovall thinks that the three big pyramids at Giza point to Orion's belt.
Sure.
So following up on those clues, I went to Google and typed in Orion and the dimensions of the Great Pyramid, and what popped back was Barnard's Loop, which measures the same number of light years as the dimensions of the Great Pyramid.
Wow. Okay.
Okay, now that piece of it, all of that really is, to begin with, is really sort of incidental. It relates to concepts of ascension.
Sure.
In Buddhism, we have concepts of personal ascension, that these ascending stages of matter that matter passes through as we create atoms are referred to as ascension in the microcosm. And there's a third concept of ascension in the macrocosm that ostensibly leads us to a gate or a door, a solar gate or a solar door between the non-material and the material universe.
Mm-hmm.
And these astronomic bodies play a role in being able to locate where that door is.
Okay. That's incredible.
So, getting back to Göbekli Tepe and trying to trace it forward, language is what lets us do that. There are ancient Egyptian words, names that look like names of our mountaintop sanctuaries that refer to the region of Turkey where Göbekli Tepe is, that point us to a particular cult, an archaic cult in India called the Shakti cult.
Mm-hmm.
And the Shakti cult is characterized by symbolic icons that are a match for what we see at Göbekli Tepe. One of the most compelling is when we translate the word Göbekli Tepe, one of the traditional translations is Potbelly Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really explains what that term means, but that's what's given out when you say, what does Göbekli Tepe mean? They say, oh, it means Potbelly Hill. Well, this Shakti cult was a matriarchal cult whose emphasis was on fertility, and one of their iconic objects was a clay pot filled with water that represented a womb called a potbelly. So we have connections like that tie this cult directly back conceptually to Göbekli Tepe. They originate in the right region to have come from there. They have all the right symbolic references and carry forward all the right stuff that relates to the later cultures to be the link from the 10,000 BC era to the 3,000 BC era.
Hmm.
And that's a large piece of the book, Point of Origin, is trying to sort that out and trying to find the clues that make that linkage.
Sure. Not an easy undertaking either, I'm sure. So on pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe, along the top of the pillar, you can see like in a series of high relief carvings. It looks like, I think, three little like stone handbags, right?
Right.
And so I find that it's pretty interesting that you see it there at Göbekli Tepe. You can also see it in some of the ancient Sumerian reliefs. You can see it the other side of the world at Leventa. I mean, have you put any research or thought into, A, what the hell are these things? And B, why do we see them all over the ancient world?
Yes, and there are a couple of different ways to explain it. In ancient symbolism in all of these different cultures, the symbolic themes often boil down to one basic theme. If you reduce fractions mentally here, what it brings you down to is the idea of trying to reconcile a non-material universe with a material universe. And there are a number of different techniques they use to do that.
Mm-hmm.
One is they associate circularity with the non-material universe, and they associate squares, like the concept of a space, with the material universe. And so in ancient Egypt, there's a mythic theme of squaring the circle. It's a mathematical function or a geometric function that is a metaphor for reconciling these two universes.
Okay.
One of the figures that does that in Egyptian hieroglyphs is a hemisphere, which is round on one side but squared on the other. Well, these handbags represent an early attempt to do that same thing.
Okay.
Now, in the earliest temples that we know about back in Iran and places like that in early times, three domes were a sort of an iconic symbol of a temple.
Mm-hmm.
And these three handbags are correlates to those three domes. They represent the idea of reconciling those two universes. In the myths of other cultures, like the Maori in New Zealand, there are stories preserved of a mythic character who ascends to the top of a mountain and brings back mythic knowledge in three handbags.
Mm-hmm.
So they look like handbags. They also take the same shape as a kind of portable shrine that defined the concept of a shrine in ancient Egypt. These were called sehs, S-E-H. And so these symbols all represent, all at the same time represent those concepts. They're intimately related to the concept of instructed knowledge, of the notion of a temple where non-materiality supposedly comes together with materialness, and the idea of reconciling those two universes together.
Wow. So, or maybe they're just actual shopping bags for ancient IKEA.
Yeah, that's right. Those are the handbags you get if you buy today's sale.
Right, right.
They're going to give you a free handbag.
Coupons inside. awesome. Okay, so you have your website, and you also, I mean, people can get on innertraditions.com to buy your books. They can also find you, I believe, in Barnes & Noble. I think I saw Point of Origin there the other day, which is awesome.
Yes.
For you. And then also Amazon or any other standard online retailer.
That's right.
Any other resources for all things Laird Scranton that our listeners should be privy of?
Well, I have a Facebook page. I'm pretty accessible there, and it's my personal page. I tend to accept friend requests from people who are interested in the books. There's a fan site. There's a LairdScranton.com fan site that I'm not responsible for, but the contact tab there does reach me. I get emails from that.
Okay.
I speak at conferences. I'll be at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis the weekend of May 13th this year.
Mm-hmm.
There are other conferences that I have spoken at over the years. I've spoken at the CPAC conference out in California.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes speak at the ARE Mysteries Conference down in Virginia Beach. I've been at the New Jersey Fringe conferences. So I try to keep posted on my Facebook page any upcoming event that might be happening.
Sure. And as we said at the beginning of the show, for people just joining us, new book this fall, correct?
That's right. The new book this fall is called The Mystery of Scarab Ray. This is Scarab Ray is a Neolithic village from around 3200 BC, just before dynastic Egypt, that the researchers there couldn't connect to anything local. They didn't know where these people came from. The architecture, the pottery, the language don't connect in any coherent way to Scandinavian or Celtic or anything like that sources. Mm-hmm. So they've been trying to sort out where does this come from. And I had been asked by an acquaintance in Australia if I thought there could have been Egyptian influences there. Mm. And I realized that at 3200 BC, the Dogon, I think, were Egyptian. All the evidence points to the fact that they were Egyptian at that point.
Wow.
So I started making comparisons between what we find architecturally at Scarabray with what we find among the Dogon. And the plan of the architectural plan of the house that they built there mm-hmm. is a match for a Dogon house. But the Dogon house carries symbolism with it, symbolism that is cosmological in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So the implication is Scarabray had the same cosmology that the Dogon did, and that there's some kind of conceptual relationship between this African tribe and these people on Orkney Island in northern Scotland. Then there are an additional series of megalithic sites on Orkney Island that were connected by a Neolithic road back in ancient times.
Mm-hmm.
You could walk past all of them in sequence, and it led you right to this little village. And what wasn't obvious to the researchers there is that these sites are sort of life-size recreations of the geometry of matter. These are the geometrical stages that matter goes through as it's created. And the Scarabray house represents a central form that the Dogon call the egg of the world, or scientists call the Calabi-Yau space of string theory.
Mm-hmm.
This is science here. So it looks as if on Orkney Island we have, at 3200 BC, again, a university where a student could actually walk through this life-size representation of what they're learning.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So this fall, though, is when we can expect that?
This December or January, probably.
Very cool.
Is the timing that I've heard so far of that book.
And also on Inner Traditions, yes?
Also on Inner Traditions, that's right.
Very good. Alrighty. Well, Laird, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. I look forward to hopefully getting you back on the show here soon. Laird Scranton, everybody. Check him out online. Check him out at innertraditions.com and also at lairdscranton.com. Also, stay tuned to Lost Origins for all things ancient mysteries, historical theories, and lost civilizations, book reviews, interviews, upcoming shows, articles, you name it, your number one source for all things ancient mystery. Thanks again, Laird. We really appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. I really appreciate it, too.
Pleasure's all ours.